This is a Village Soundcast Network original production.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Lends Me Your Ears. This is a film podcast where we look at a movie currently in cinemas and compare and contrast it to cinema of days gone by, genre, filmmakers, and otherwise. My name is Karsten Knox. I'm a film writer. I've got a blog called Flaw in the Iris you can find at halifaxbloggers.ca.
And I'm Stephen Cook, and I'm an arts writer here in Halifax with the Chronicle Herald.
On today's episode, we are going to talk about movies that are super popular that we just don't like, that we can't get our heads around, we can't get our interest into, and we love movies, but we don't love these. So I guess we're going to break free with some of our inner haters.
It's kind of our naysayer contrarian edition.
The F-bombing New York Times bestsellers, Thug Kitchen. Gwyneth Paltrow's two-time co-author, Julia Tertian. The polite and proper Great British Bake Off's food stylist. What do they all have in common? They're all at the intersection of culinary arts and pop culture. And they've all been guests on The Food Podcast, a Village Soundcast network production where personal stories are shared through the lens of food. If you really want to connect with someone, just write them a letter. It was a dark and stormy night. The only light came from a lantern swinging from the gatepost. A pathway to where? What's your pathway? What's in your brown paper bag?
I think for me, it's more about a feeling, is that when I'm writing about food, I'm really writing about people.
It was a springboard to learn about culture, history, and of course, health.
As a story, I almost want there to be some internal conflict, even if it is just eggs or French toast.
I am the architect of my own health. I decide what direction I go in. I build its foundation with every thought I think and with what I eat.
Thanks for listening. I'm Lindsay Cameron Wilson.
Suffice it to say, we see a lot of movies over the course of a year, both the new stuff in theaters, if, say, it's something that we're going to be writing about, or just stuff we go to see for the fun of it, or if we're lucky, because in this neck of the woods, we don't get a lot of older movies showing up on the big screen. But lately, there have been kind of a classic of the month series at Cineplex and some other special presentations and so on. Usually, they screen it a couple times over the course of a month, and you have to scramble to try and make some of those screenings. I know that in August, Planet of the Apes is going to be on the big screen at Cineplex Cinemas, at specially chosen Cineplex Cinemas across Canada, so I got to scramble to try and get to one of those because I've never seen it in a theater, and I love that film going back to my childhood. So and of course, you know, certainly we talk about Netflix on here sometimes, and there's a mix of made for the small screen and theatrical features that show up on there. And of course, we both collect movies on digital media, DVDs, and I certainly still have VHS and Laserdisc kicking around the old apartment.
that's on you, buddy. I've got onto Blu-ray myself. Although I do have quite a few. I still have more DVDs than Blu-rays, that's for sure.
And in fact, when we did our Paul Schrader episode, we wanted to talk about Blue Collar, but the only copy that was handy was my VHS copy, and it was buried in a box somewhere in the back of a storage locker, and I didn't feel like searching for it. So I've since ordered a DVD of that film at the low price of $6.98 from Amazon. So I figure we will be able to watch that, not in time for the show that's already, you know, been posted and everything, but at least we'll be able to do some catching up that way. But we watch a lot of films, and not all of them are good. And sometimes we see stuff that is, you know, been deemed to be overwhelmingly popular, and we kind of scratch our heads at it, and you know, it happens. And then I watch stuff that I know is utter dreck, especially weird programmers from the 30s and 40s that nobody in their right mind should be watching in this day and age. But for some reason, if it's TCM took the trouble to air this strange entry in some nondescript detective series, featuring Warren William, the star that nobody remembers, then darn it, I'm going to watch that film and add it to the bottomless pit of cinematic necessity for myself.
Yeah, so. And I have a weak spot for anything that resembles a sort of a spy picture, like especially if it has international European locations, then I'm all over that. And that's my weak spot. And occasionally a good indie film that maybe didn't get a cinematic release here but has an actor in it that I really like, or a filmmaker whose work previously I've appreciated, I'll track that down. And sometimes I can find that on VOD. And so these are the kinds of things that happen. We oversaturate ourselves. And so sometimes, I mean, this is the curse of being serious about film and writing about it and talking about it, is that we are patients for the wide release blockbuster or, you know, what have you, whatever it is that becomes very popular completely. I'll just speak for myself. I am unable to understand the appeal. And I get pretty critical when I'm, when I see all that money on the screen, especially for the big Hollywood blockbusters. And I just go, what a waste. And then, you know, you hear the record block, you hear the box office to be over the moon, and you're just like, how is this possible? So, you know, I don't want to be a hater. I don't think you're a hater, Stephen. I think we have a lot of love for film in general. But we figured, well, at this time out, we're gonna talk about the ones that kind of get under our skin, and we're just gonna air some of that frustration with feature films. And we chose to do this now because there was a recent release of a massive blockbuster, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. Now, this is a film that I didn't hate. I didn't love it, and I think it has lots of problems. But as far as a giant dinosaur movie goes, I was, you know, there were things about it I didn't mind. Part of the reason I think I didn't mind it was because I came to it with such low expectations, having been set by Jurassic World in 2015, which was maybe my least favorite movie that year. It is number 5 on the list of the biggest box office hits of all time. That was the Colin Trevorrow film. And I thought it was just terrible. I thought that it was a pale imitation of Steven Spielberg's original 1993 adaptation of the Michael Crichton book. I thought it was the worst kind of reboot, a cynical carbon copy effort where nothing, not the acting, the story, the special effects, nor the thrill of the thing, approaches the standard set by Spielberg's original. It made a movie which came out around the same summer, Mad Max Fury Road, also based on a fallow franchise, seemed like that much more of a miracle because it was so good. So I really hated Jurassic World. So coming to see this second part of this reboot, I was like, oh, this actually is kind of entertaining. It had a few surprises and a little bit of heart, even though it didn't make a lot of sense. I mean, the fact that anyone goes back to this island and wants to have anything to do with these dinosaurs at all doesn't make a lot of sense, because as evidence has shown, multiple movies now, anytime you get close to these things, they eat you.
Yeah, the weaponized dinosaurs. What could possibly go wrong? I did not care for the first Jurassic World entry. I kind of tempered my reservations. It's not that I was in love with the original Jurassic Park movies by any means. I thought the first one was okay. I thought the second one was unnecessary. And the third one, which Spielberg did not direct, I thought was at least done with a sense of fun. Joe Johnston, who did Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, took over. And he brought more of a sense of fun to it. He should have brought Rick Moranis to it too, but I guess he was taking some time off from the big screen. But at least the third one had more of that kind of feel of something like Valley of the Guanji or something like that. It was more in the spirit of maybe some of those Ray Harryhausen kind of movies where you're not supposed to take it deadly seriously. And he kind of tried to move away from the classic Spielberg cliches, like the sweeping camera movements and the people looking up and all. Like, you know, he tried to distance himself from that and make the third one stand out a little bit more and be more of a popcorn movie, if you will. It's not my favorite phrase in the world, but that's exactly what it was. So that was sort of my low bar, was that, oh, maybe it'll be a good popcorn movie.
Yeah.
But because it turns out the bar was set relatively high by those that first trilogy of Jurassic Park movies, Jurassic World felt so kind of formulaic and by the numbers. And, obviously the technology to create these creatures and have them interact with humans had come ahead by leaps and bounds and pterodactyl plunges since those first movies. And they really kind of make the most of it of that in the first of the, you know, reboot films and also the current one. And certainly, technology's ability to make us suspend our disbelief, as it were, has certainly improved. But it kind of wasted the talents of some likable actors. Chris Pratt was just kind of taciturn and grim and unlikable, and it was like, why would you hire him for this role if you're gonna get him. I don't think he's the kind of actor that can play against type necessarily. And I was kind of hoping maybe they'd flesh out his character a little bit more in the second one, and they don't really.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's just something sour about it.
That just didn't
grab me.
I totally agree. Well, the first one had the two kids, which were entirely personality free, who are involved in the story, and they're somehow related to Bryce Dallas Howard's character. I guess they're nephews, and she is also not all that appealing in any respect. I mean, she's not an interesting character. She's kind of her loyalties, I guess, are challenged, which is interesting because when she comes back in the second film,
she's a different character.
She's a quite different character. She's in completely reversed her values that were established in the first film. And you know, okay, so maybe she learned a thing or two, but still, I would say maybe the biggest improvement in the second from the first film is the reintroduction of Jeff Goldblum. Even though he's barely in it.
The
trailers suggest he's quite a presence in the film, but he's there for like 90 seconds of screen time.
Yeah, I think most of what you see in the film is in the trailer of Jeff Goldblum. You know, that's in the, you know, it's condensed a little bit, but basically what you see is what you get.
Yeah. So, you know, and it feels like the second Jurassic World movie repeats some of the tropes of the second Jurassic Park movie, wherein they take the monsters off the island. And you know, of course, and they introduce a character, Rafe, played by Rafe Spall, who's supposed to be the sort of philanthropist. He's going to help these animals. But of course, I mean, it's Rafe Spall. If you've been paying any attention to his career, he plays a lot of bad guys and a lot of antagonists. And it's no surprise when in fact he has other ambitions for these creatures. He's going to, he's going to make a lot of money with them. And then when it switches to this enormous house wherein there is an auction going on in the basement, that's when it gets somewhat interesting. I did like that there was a darker thematic tone at play with Fallen Kingdom that our heroes, despite their best intentions, are partly responsible for the catastrophic presence of these sort of rebirth, unnatural life in our modern world, and that the technology, if it exists, humans will inevitably use it, leading to our own self-destruction. That's a very Michael Crichton-esque sentiment that I can get behind, and that felt true to what I think these stories are really about. It reminded me a little bit of the current season of Westworld, which is so much better than this kind of storytelling. But, you know, there were both, I mean, if you think about the original Westworld movie from 73 and then Jurassic Park from 93, they're basically the same story. And that's what Crichton was interested in. So it's interesting how to see these material, this sort of intellectual property reborn, and then one work really well and one, you know, just feel like the lowest common denominator. And again, I know this is a big hit this summer. People are loving this movie, and I scratch my head about it, but then I realize, well, you do not underestimate the draw of dinosaurs. People love dinosaurs. Kids especially dinosaurs. And this is a monster movie, and monster movies, you know, as we've done a monster movie show, monster movies, people adore those too.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not without its positive moments. Toby Jones is pretty much good in everything. I didn't like his Truman Capote movie, but that was really his fault. The presence of Ted Levine as the evil, mercenary for hire, who's leading the fairly scruffy bunch who are in charge of rounding up the dinosaurs and bringing them to this mansion. It just seems like a mansion. It's just the wrong place to bring a bunch of dinosaurs. I don't care.
Like, how big is this mansion? And the fact that James Cromwell is up in the upper floors, you know, basically managing his illness, and he has no idea all this is going on. That seems strange to me.
Yeah, there's that too. And, and Geraldine Chaplin shows up as his kind of, as Cromwell's sort of assistant / mistress, or they try to lay down some mythology kind of late in the film, and it's a little too much too late, maybe, or too little too late for this film. But of course they do, you know, everything at the end of this film points the way towards a third installment. It's got to be another trilogy, and I'm hoping that, you know, dinosaurs on the loose in society on the mainland gives us something a little more promising than what we've seen before.
And maybe some real scares. Like one thing I really did like about Jurassic Park was that Spielberg's sense of suspense and something he, you know, has had well developed going back to Jaws and Duel was very much present in those films. Like these are terrifying creatures, and humans seem very vulnerable when you look into the eye of the velociraptors. Whereas that's something that Colin Trevorrow entirely forgot, and Jay Bayona, who directed this Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, seems to have brought into it a little bit, but there's still a ways that we could go with this. Like, there could be some genuine fear and scares in this film that aren't here, and you know, keep your fingers crossed for a third edition, because you know it's coming, at least that it'll be another step in the right direction from these two, because I can't say that I'll ever want to watch any of these again. Maybe they'll bring back Sam Neill and Laura Dern. That would be nice too.
Well, bringing back Goldblum in this film maybe points toward seeing maybe some other familiar faces in the third and, let's hope, final installment. But I know that there was a feeling that I think the Lost World up the second film after the original Jurassic Park, I think up the scary quotient a little bit from the first film, because there were complaints that those who knew and loved the book felt that Spielberg kind of removed its teeth, if you will, in a lot of ways.
Okay.
Like I think some harm does befall at least one of the kids, in the original story, and I, you know, and then Lost World, Jurassic Park 2, if you will. I think it opens up with a couple of kids encountering these cute little baby dinosaurs, and then they're overrun by them early in the film. So, and that kind of like gave us some hope that, okay, this one's going to have a little more, if you excuse it, this bite to it than the first one did in that area. Didn't really necessarily, but at least it was a promising sign. So I'm hoping, and you know, they're obviously going to be shooting for another PG-13 with the next one. So there's only so far they can go, but
sure.
As long as there's not too much blood spilled, at least literal blood as opposed to a body count, then they're probably okay.
You know, I'm a sci-fi geek and grew up with Star Wars and Star Trek. Star Trek on TV, Star Wars in the cinema, and then eventually Star Trek in the cinema as well. Next Gen, when it came along in the late 80s, I was really into that. And I always felt like Star Wars was something part of my childhood. Star Trek actually I was able to take with me into my adulthood, because some of those stories were pretty sophisticated, and the fact that it was a series on television, they could get into stuff that didn't necessarily require the kind of budget that a giant sci-fi film requires, and which is explosions and action. They could actually get into some philosophical, societal, what have you. There's some depth to some of those stories. And so when J.J. Abrams rebooted Star Trek as an admitted Star Wars fan, I was a little concerned. Now, 2009 Star Trek was actually pretty clever. I liked how they were able to sort of use this alternative time frame to reintroduce these characters sort of as an alternate dimension. And I liked that. I thought that was cleverly done. And I was like, okay, that's pretty cool. Right. When are we going to get Star Trek back on television? Was what kind of my reaction to it. Like, okay, that's fine. But. And then Star Trek Into Darkness arrived in 2013, directed by J.J. Abrams. I really loathe this film. I felt no like kidding. They did everything wrong. It was such a departure from what I think is truly interesting about Star Trek. And it also doubled down on this idea that they had to sort of reinterpret the original stories, basically redoing the Space Seed and Star Trek Wrath of Khan, Star Trek II Wrath of Khan, in this one film. And they made it basically terrible. They made whatever was good about that story, they soured it. It was the one time where I felt like I had any kind of sympathy for those online trolls who complain about their childhood being ruined, you know, except this wasn't my childhood. I guess this was my like young adulthood being just like, come on, this, you know, if it had been just a self-contained science fiction story, I would probably have had much more time for it than trying to sort of get my brain around how this related to anything I liked about Star Trek. And so I was just, it just infuriated me. I took to the internet and I said, I hate this movie and you guys have done terrible things to it. So I wrote this scathing review for whatever it's worth. Anyway, they came back with a third, Star Trek Beyond, which was actually kind of charming. It wound up capturing more of the spirit of the classic Trek than I would have expected. But again, by then, my expectations were so low any improvement was, in my mind, a great thing. So, yeah, but Star Trek Into Darkness was the one. And, of course, there were people who didn't love it, and it didn't get a lot of love from the nerdarati on the whole. I think it was fairly mixed, the reception. I was steaming mad coming out of that cinema.
Yeah, I don't know why they had to go that way. I don't understand what the rationale was for telling a story that's already been told basically twice before in two, varying different ways. The original Star Trek, the motion picture, I remember that made me mad back in 1970, whenever, the Robert Wise film.
77, sure.
Because it was essentially a remake of an episode of the original series where, they recapture a satellite, V'ger.
Right.
Which turns out to be Voyager.
Oh, actually, maybe it was more like 79.
It was after Star Wars.
Right.
Because I think Roddenberry had been trying to get a Star Trek movie made, and it wasn't until Star Wars took off that, we own this property, maybe we should do something with
it. Sure.
And but it basically recycled the idea of this, Earth-made satellite that comes back a higher intelligence. And,
right.
And, and I remember watching it, even though I was like 11 or 12 or whatever, I was like, this seems really familiar. And then once I realized it was basically the same, although it added a new wrinkle with Percy's Kambada sort of becoming the physical embodiment of the satellite. But I feel like that had been done too on the original Star Trek where a crew member gets possessed by higher intelligence.
Sure.
And I think that's a different episode though, Whom the Gods Destroy or whatever. I can't remember exactly. I don't have all my original, as much as I love original Star Trek, I don't have much of it memorized, but it felt like a pretty flabby beginning. The film itself is kind of slow going and there's a lot of, it's nice to be back with those characters, but at the same time, you miss the zippiness of a 1 hour episode over the course of this 2 hour plus movie. And then, of course, with Wrath of Khan, they even though they were continuing the story with Ricardo Montalban and everything, it felt like it was building on the mythology instead of just copying it. But of course, Into Darkness, it's back to copying and just cribbing. It's like it just felt like somebody like rewriting something out of an encyclopedia and passing it in as homework, essentially. Yeah. And I saw it the weekend it came out, and I think I saw it before I knew too much about it. And partway through the film, once I realized, oh, they're just doing Wrath of Khan again. This is a total waste of time. And then he actually comes out and says that he's Khan, and it's like, oh, they're not even just pretending that it's something new. It's just a rehash of like, why am I sitting here? And there seemed to be something kind of smug about it. Like Abrams and crew, like they were pulling a fast one on us or something.
Yeah.
A surprise.
Yeah. And, but it was clear. It was so obvious. Why they even tried to hide it. And then they do, and this is a little bit of a spoiler, folks. So I don't know. I would never recommend you see this film, and I can't imagine anyway, but I'm going to tell you something about what happens in the third act here, which is that a character who died in Wrath of Khan, it's flipped. They flip the two characters, one who lives and one who dies. And it feels so calculated. It feels so almost tongue-in-cheek. And it just feels like they've crapped all over this much beloved fantasy property with this choice. I mean, it just feels, there's something calculated, there's something misjudged, and it's just something plain wrong about that.
Yeah, and of course the beauty of Wrath of Khan is Ricardo Montalban is, he's such a powerful screen presence. I mean, not that Cumberbatch isn't, but Montalban just had this fury within him, and was the bad guy, but also generated an insane amount of sympathy for his plight. I mean, this guy and his followers had really been screwed around by the I want to say the Empire, but of course it's not the Empire. It's the Federation.
Yeah.
I often Star Trek and Star Wars sometimes merge in my brain. But there was always that, and I think that's a Roddenberry thing. Like, it was rare on Star Trek that you'd get a villain that was completely and fully evil. There'd always be a sympathetic, either they're just misunderstood or you had to turn around and see things from their point of view. And that was kind of his take on the Cold War, I guess, that he was all, I guess the Russians love their children too.
Thank you, Sting.
Sting in Space. Where's that movie?
It's called Dune.
Oh, right. Yes.
I will kill you.
But Cumberbatch, brings that kind of cold, calculating presence to the role. And I just wish maybe they invested that in a completely different character and not in something that we've seen a better version of, 20 years or 30 years before, however long it's been. So, yeah, kind of a failure in space on that one.
Yeah, it really is. I don't think I'm ever going to want to go back and watch that ever again. And, but it's funny, when you mentioned the Star Trek motion picture, I have gone back to watch that. And I kind of got it. Like, I didn't like it, like yourself, I didn't like it much when I was young. But in years hence, I've watched it and I've appreciated the pacing of it and how they're trying to create a mood using, cinematic storytelling, but also special effects. And it's so different than so many of those TV episodes that it feels a little bit like it's, I don't know, it feels a little ill-advised. But at the same time, I wound up enjoying it a lot more than I expected.
I think there are still pleasures to be had in that film because we do have, I think all of the original cast intact, more or less, hair pieces and otherwise. But and it's also practical effects and models. So it's, spaceships move like in a comprehensible physical way. They're not driving in the Starship Enterprise like it's a Ferrari, and dodging meteors and whatever. It still makes sense in a linear, logical kind of way, even though it's familiar. And there is a lot of emphasis on character and like you say, in mood and so on. And let's face it, space travel would have to be really boring. So not that any film needs to be set in outer space and be really boring, but it's, when films can kind of convey that sort of routine and so on, the way that, say, Solaris or 2001 Space Odyssey or whatever can. I'm not saying that Star Trek, the motion picture was trying to be realistic in its portrayal of life in space, but yeah, you're right. The pacing is it seems slow by comparison to today's standards, but it's still, it works for those characters and everything. And a lot of the things that people had issues with that film aren't necessarily the things that I have issue with compared to, the plot elements and unoriginality, but it can be fun just to go back and spend time with those characters. I mean, that's even true of some of the lesser entries in the series before they finally do away with the whole Enterprise thing, and kill off Kirk and so on. The one that, was it five? The one
where they meet God?
Where they meet God and Chatter directs.
Yes.
I like elements of that. It's not, it's a weirder entry in that series. But then, of course, the same with the TV series. There's, for every trouble with Tribbles, you've got to put up with a bunch of hippies going down to Eden.
Yeah.
A few episodes later. So
I agree. There are some of the movie versions that really don't work. But I'll just say this as a longtime Star Trek, a Trekkie, Trekker, that I am glad that it's back on television. That's where it belongs. And I really enjoyed much of Star Trek Discovery last season. So I'm hoping that continues and they really find their feet in the next season. And there were lots of things about it I liked about that show. So anyway, all of which to say is I didn't, my It hasn't been soured. My bad experience with Star Trek Into Darkness hasn't soured my feeling about the franchise as a whole. I still think that there's a lot of good that can come from more stuff, and let's hope that it sticks to TV, because I think that's where it does that has, you know, it has the best chance of doing what it's best at.
Yeah, I think you know, smaller, more focused stories. Although the last Star Trek feature did kind of pull the fat out of the fire with some interesting aliens and some twists and so on. So, you know, there's hope that that will continue, but we'll see.
Yeah.
Speaking of disappointment in space, did you see Solo by any chance?
Since we've talked about Star Trek, should we move over to Star Wars?
This is kind of a free form sort of show.
Sure.
I mean, we have a theme of sorts, but I realize, you know, we haven't talked about a lot of the big blockbusters of the summer. Why talk about an Avengers movie or whatever? But Solo is the one that seems to be kind of mixed feelings about it.
Yeah, I would say that it's funny. I had a long conversation with Lucas, my friend Lucas, who is a filmmaker, on that podcast I do on associated with my blog, the Flaw in the Iris podcast, and he was a huge fan of Solo. He was all over it. He thought it's the best of the recent Star Wars movies. He even thought maybe it's the best since Empire Strikes Back, and I was like, whoa, really? Because, dude, I had such a different experience with it. Like, I didn't actively, you know, like, I wasn't really annoyed by it, but I just felt like it was a missed opportunity, and I felt like, what was it that didn't work about it? Like, I like Alden Ehrenreich as an actor, and I think that he has moments in the film, but it almost felt like the movie was where he wasn't the lead. Like, I felt like his character arc and his emotional journey was less interesting than everyone around him. And then they cast Donald Glover as Lando, and he is like a charisma bomb. Like,
oh yeah, he totally knocks that character out of the park.
Yeah,
by not overdoing it, for one thing. He plays it cool, and that's Lando. So.
Yeah, totally, totally. And I mean, he is so, if I can say, he is so hot right now with that, and with his work with Atlanta, which is terrific, and then Childish Gambino. I mean, he's one of the biggest rising stars in America right now, so you can't help but watch that guy. And we miss him when he's not on screen. So there's that. There's other characters in the story. The character played by Emilia Clarke is also really interesting. Like, there's all sorts of conflict going on there, and unfortunately, Solo himself comes off as kind of like more of a Luke Skywalker character. Like, he's very immature, he's very naive, and, you know, I didn't buy it. I'm like, the Han Solo that I know and love always had a little bit of cynicism to him. Even when he was young, he must have had that same. He probably was just cockier. He's probably more of a pain in the butt to be around than he became. I think by the time that we meet him, and he's, say, around 30, during Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, he has found maybe a little bit of softness, a little bit of goodness, and that's the moment, that's his character journey in those films. But I would always imagine that back in the day, he was probably someone who was a lot more likely to do the wrong thing than the right thing. And I felt like the writers of this film got that wrong.
Yeah, well, of course, we all know what a jumble the production of the film was, you know, with the original team being fired partway through production, and then Ron, no sharp edges, Howard, stepping in to finish it off, and, you know, and doing a competent job of making a reasonably fun space opera adventure film. But, you know, it could have been so much more than that, you know, given that Han Solo, you know, could use a little more complexity. I mean, we know this character, you know, has a lot of darkness in him, but kind of got pared away over the course of, you know, the original Star Wars trilogy. But, you know, the guy we meet in that Mos Eisley cantina who shoots Greedo first, of course, as we would prefer to think of him, you know, that guy is not the guy we see at the end of Solo.
No.
So
the presumption being there are more movies to come that bring him there.
I guess so. But you know, the guy's an orphan, so he should be pretty, and, you know, he's a young adult and kind of alone. So you think he should have some of that misanthropic characteristic right off the get-go. And it feels like it's sort of there early in the film, and maybe that's Chris Miller or whatever, the original team. Maybe
Lord and Miller, yeah.
Lord and Miller. I think maybe that's some of their doing, where at the start, it seems like he's a little more hard-bitten and rough and ready. But then when we get into the main storyline, he sort of softens up and, you know, looks to Woody Harrelson to be kind of lead the story along until it becomes time for them to kind of split ways. And it just doesn't feel quite right. Like, it feels like he should be, you know, getting some teeth along the way. And that's not really what the film does. It's one of those films where I did enjoy it on a base level of, you know, just having fun watching a roller coaster-y kind of movie unfold. But of course, it's part of such a bigger mythology with so much more potential for depth, even if it's not always there, that it could have been a lot more. Well, we don't have a ton of time left. We're in the last segment of the show, and we can maybe chill out and look at some films from years past that have sort of become classics over the years, have kind of been lauded as either Oscar winners or, you know, box office greats, or even just fondly remembered films from childhood or whatever that don't necessarily have the same resonance for either of us. And I'm trying to think of where to start with this list. A good example would be a director whose name has already come up in association with some giant dinosaur movies, and that's Steven Spielberg, generally regarded as the greatest Hollywood blockbuster director currently working. I mean, he's still prolific. We've had The Post and Ready Player One in pretty short order over the last year or so. And, you know, certainly I think it's safe to say has had more hits than misses over the course of his career. And even the films that don't necessarily knock it out of the park box office-wise are often quite interesting and well-made and have something to recommend them. Often those are the kind of films of his that we might even prefer, like an Empire of the Sun or Munich or, you know, some of these films that, you know, on paper might be regarded as misfires by some in the biz, but are maybe his more mature and more thought out films. And then there are films like, say, Always, which I've met people that love that film.
But it does not work. Audrey Hepburn is a draw, but otherwise I can't really.
And she's totally wasted.
Yeah, I can't really think of why. Now, my of Spielberg's canon, and, you know, people adore him. I mean, I absolutely love Jaws. I love Raiders. I love Close Encounters, of those early ones. I do not love E.T., and I feel like I'm at a meeting and admitting, you know, my problem with E.T. I think part of the problem was, I mean, I saw it when it came out. I saw it when I was about 12, which feels like a right age to see a movie like that. And I remember not being that into movies about kids. Like, I wanted to see movies about adults, and I've never been. I was never a kid who wanted to see movies about other kids, and so that was part of the problem. I also felt even then that movie was one of the more manipulative of Spielberg's work. Like, I just was like, I almost was resenting that he was trying to make me cry at the end, and he was so blatant about it with the John Williams score and this super cute, though strangely ugly, alien. And, I get what he was doing, and I love the way he created this sort of, like, magical world within suburbia in America. I think that's one of the things that the film really does well. But I have never had any interest in revisiting E.T., watching it again recent years. I've had lots of opportunities. I'm just not on board.
Well, you're not alone. I'm not a fan of E.T. either. I did not see it when it came out. I remember it played at the Highland Theater, which no longer exists, but it was at the Armdale Roundabout, for those of you who live in Halifax and know the geography, right at the end of the Northwest Arm there. There used to be a great one-screen theater called the Highland Theater, and it was kind of a kind of a 50s kind of theater. It wasn't a grand movie palace like, say, the Capitol or even the Casino on Goddard Street. You know, it was a more, kind of a suburban single-screen theater. Of course, there were these new blossoming communities just across the Arm and Armdale and Spryfield, Fairview, and that kind of thing. So that was kind of the market it was built to service. And, and then for a while there, it was kind of an art house theater. That's where it was owned initially by Odeon and then Empire. And now it's condos or something. It blew up. Somebody left the popcorn machine on overnight and exploded. And the theater kind of actually imploded from the backdraft. Not that the movie was playing, but the actual backdraft from the fire. E.T. played there for, I swear, for like 3 months or something like that. Like, it was crazy. And this is one of the reasons why they moved to multiplex. You could run a movie for that long, and just because you have multiple screens to juggle titles around. In those days, back by popular demand or held over by popular demand, but it really put a crimp in trying to, keep the cycle going of new theatrical features. And, I kind of resented its overwhelming popularity. It was
right.
Such a huge hit. And I like Spielberg's work. I think I'd seen Jaws by that point, Close Encounters, and enjoyed those films. I hadn't seen his first two features, Duel and Sugarland Express, yet. But, I enjoyed the films that I had seen. But somehow the idea of a cute alien didn't catch my fancy. I was like, I wanted aliens to be mean and, like Alien.
Or The Thing.
Yeah, exactly. Not a cute kind of dignified kind of alien. And so I didn't actually see it. Now, mind you, I didn't watch it on home video. I actually waited until there was some sort of anniversary reissue. And it might have been the one where they threatened to digitally remove the guns.
I remember,
yeah. And replace them with walkie-talkies and, change some of the dialogue. And I think at the last minute, he decided not to alter the film. And I don't know that that version ever saw the light of day.
I don't know. I didn't see it. I didn't go back.
So this version, the one that I saw, I remember did have, the guns. And I think one of the kids calls one of the other kids, like, penis breath or something like that. Yeah, I didn't enjoy the overt manipulation. John Williams working overtime to make these images kind of, make your heart flutter or whatever. And, it's the really obvious kind of Christ allegory really got on my nerves, the way they kind of played it up. I mean, obviously, Spielberg's kind of reaching back and borrowing from, like, King of Kings and these, classic biblical epic Jesus movies, and I didn't like that aspect of it either. And of course, using kids to kind of hype that sentimentality is like box office poison, as far as I'm concerned. So I came away from it with the same kind of, like, I wasn't feeling exhilarated. And I know some people love the film; they love when the bikes take flight, and I do have to say that there are some aspects of the film where it does a good job of portraying the life of kids at that time and, how they relate to their parents and their siblings. I think it does a pretty good job of that. I think that's in Melissa Matheson's screenplay. Those are the strong elements of her writing that come to the fore. But then, when Spielberg pours on the treacle is what pulls me away from that.
Yeah, it's he does Sense of Wonder really well. And I see that in the film, and I remember it well from the film. But I feel exactly like you did. I was just kind of like, this just isn't for me. And it's funny, it's weird feeling that when it's such a huge, it taps into the zeitgeist and becomes the biggest movie ever, like the biggest box office hit for years. It was the record holder.
I didn't even want to buy Reese's Pieces after seeing it. So much for product placement.
Now, speaking of films that, and it was all also for Best Picture that year. It did not win. Gandhi won, of all things.
Yes.
But speaking
Tootsie
of...
Tootsie was robbed.
Yeah, seriously. Of Oscar contenders, Forrest Gump is another on my list of movies that I cannot get on board with. When it came out in 94, I was so annoyed by it. I remember it in Ottawa, and I remember walking out of the cinema just cheesed off, and I couldn't figure out necessarily why. And then I thought about it some more, and I realized it was mostly due to the subplot involving Jen A, Forrest's true love, played by Robin Wright. She's a thoughtful, independent woman who goes her own way and is rewarded for it by illness and death. And the implication is, if she just stayed with simple, innocent Forrest, and been a good wife instead of being a free-thinking activist, she never would have caught AIDS and died. And so, you know, there's more to the politics of the thing, you know, and there was, but that was the crux of it. And when the, and of course, it was the problem, my problem with it was doubly felt when at the Academy Awards in early 95, it won Best Picture over four stellar and more deserving films, in my opinion: Pulp Fiction, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Quiz Show, and The Shawshank Redemption. Classics all in their own way, each one of those, and arrayed against this collection, this slab of conservative Americana, won the day, which I just, it just drove me crazy. So anyway, I should admit, though, a while back I stumbled across Forrest Gump on TV while channel surfing, and I watched maybe a third of it or something, and I was still bugged by the politics, but I did find myself enjoying Tom Hanks' performance. I think he is really good in the film, and I think about, you know, it's kind of Woody Allen Zelig for the heartland, and and I sort of felt like, you know, if thinking about Tom Hanks in it and comparing it to his role in Philadelphia as Andrew Beckett in the year before, I mean, it's hard to believe it's the same guy. It's an astonishing range that he showed right then, and of course, you know, deservedly he won both Academy Awards for Best Actors those years. You know, so I think there is something to be said for movies that catch the zeitgeist, that have become a cultural event, and there's no arguing with it. But I will continue to deny that life is in any way like a box of chocolates.
It'll kill you, just like a box of chocolates. You know, it's a slow death, but yeah, it'll get you in the end. I'm not a huge fan of Forrest Gump either. That weird retrograde philosophy that it puts across, you know, it's almost like, you know, conservatives who just wish it could be like the Eisenhower 1950s all over again, and, you know, or the Nixon years or something like that. And it's, you know, it's a message that, you know, being a progressive thinker and you know, just be a simpleton and good things will come to you. I don't buy any of it. There are good things in it, of course. Gary Sinise is fantastic.
Yeah, he is good.
As Lieutenant Dan, Captain Dan, I can't remember. Anyway, but I saw it once in the theater, and that was plenty. And Sally Fields is very good as the mom, although as many are fond of pointing out, like, it was only a few years earlier that Sally Field actually played, like, remember The Punchline? She was with Tom Hanks.
As his love interest or something, wasn't it?
I don't know if they were quite... I saw The Punchline when it came out. I don't know that they became lovers, but they were certainly, like, equals age-wise. She plays a housewife who wants to become a stand-up comic. And Hanks is kind of the cynical comedian who decides to coach her, as it were.
Right.
And, you know, and actually that's a really good Hanks performance, because he's kind of unlikable, which is not something that he plays too often. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are other examples of it throughout his filmography, but that was one of the earliest examples that I can think of. But yeah, there was a sour undertone to that movie. And I find Zemeckis always, you know, just takes those few steps too far in most of his films. Like, I just find he either goes over a line in terms of, you know, what makes sense for the story, or, you know, what would draw us into it. And I remember liking some of his early work, but, you know, I think once he stopped working with Bob, I think Bob Gale was his sort of writing and producing partner. Once Bob Gale cashed out around the time of Back to the Future, you know, he just really hasn't worked since, right, you know, except on other Back to the Future related projects. You know, I think he just figured out, like, I never need to work another day in my life. Why am I killing myself for this for? Because I really don't know what Bob Gale's been doing since Back to the Future. But, you know, Zemeckis kind of plows ahead and has made some sort of, you know, a string of unnoteworthy films. I'm trying to think.
I like Contact, but
I'm not a fan of Contact.
There are plenty of other forgettable Zemeckis pictures in the years since.
You know, Roger Rabbit would be the one good film I can pull out of that later period. And even that's kind of bitter and weird and dark, but because of the setting and the whole animation theme, I can kind of go with it. And Bob Hoskins is so great in it. But, you know, I guess The Walk wasn't too bad. That might be the best film of his later career. But then there's Polar Express, for which I can never forgive him for. That is such a nightmare at the Nightmare at the North Pole would be a better title for that film, but that, that's just me, I guess.
Yeah, no, fair enough, fair enough. I do want to say, by the way, that I have another on my list here that won the Academy Award the year after Forrest Gump, and that was Braveheart, which I just find, I remember people comparing it favorably to Last of the Mohicans, which I find as a much more successful and emotionally engaging and impressive action film, whereas Braveheart just feels to me way over the top. It allows Mel Gibson the chance to further his martyred self-flagellation to the point where it gets kind of sickening. And there's something totally bro-y about the movie. Like, it's just very masculine in that sort of toxic way.
Yes.
And I just don't have much time for it. Though I will say his later film, Apocalypto, still impresses me. But this one, I never want to see it again. Every time it comes on, I'm just like, oh, would you just stop yelling?
Freedom, which wasn't a concept at the time. Yeah, Braveheart. Oh, man. It's what's the most positive thing that's come out of Braveheart? Guys painting themselves blue at football games in Scotland. I don't know. It's not a film that's aged well, but I think that's often the case with Oscar winners. Like, often the film that wins, if you look historically at the list of Best Picture winners, most of them don't age particularly well.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the next year was English Patient, a film which now apparently nobody ever liked, which is, you know, and I will go on record saying, well, I liked it at the time.
Yeah, me too.
I haven't revisited it. But
Anthony Minghella had lots of good work.
I think maybe it just people thought of it as being endemic of the kind of film that wins Oscars. You know, the kind of fancy, vaguely foreign British kind of production that seems designed, and Saul Zance as a producer is kind of, you know, is like,
he's the king of those.
Like Harvey Weinstein would become, you know, kind of would always pitch films in that direction. Braveheart didn't have much competition that year. Apollo 13 was probably maybe the best film of the bunch. Il Postino was thought to be the underdog. I mean, that's a lovely film. Mm. Maybe not best picture.
Sense and Sensibility I liked.
But yeah, of all those films, that would be the one I'd go back and watch. Babe might have the most devoted following of any of them these days. I mean, the year the English Patient won, that was, you know, it won over Fargo and,
right,
you know, Jerry Maguire, Secrets and Lies, which is an amazing film, Shine, which is a terrific biopic. You know, so certainly it was the best of that particular bunch. But, you know, that's a whole other show. Oscar winners are always contentious and almost always not necessarily the best of the bunch. I mean, even like Shape of Water, which is a film I enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
I love Guillermo del Toro. It's not his best film
by
any stretch. So I don't know that it was necessarily the best film of that year either, but it was cool to see it win. And I guess that's maybe what people thought it would be cool to see it win.
Yeah.
But I don't know that was his film that should have been in that position. But, you know, it brought a lot of attention to his work. And
yeah, you know, and it felt like a body of work award in some ways, because
those are fairly common.
He had that show of his creative work and his collection, his sort of ephemera collection in Toronto that I saw last year, and it was amazing. But it reminded me of how consistent his vision has been. And I rare to say anything bad about a Guillermo del Toro film, and I was glad to see him get recognized as a sci-fi genre picture, especially, which so rarely does. But anyway, we are getting a little bit off topic. This is kind of we're taking pot shots at blockbusters, and yeah, I totally agree with you. The Oscars is full of them. I mean, is anyone going to want to watch Argo again? I mean, even The Artist, which seemed to me like such a perverse choice. I mean, a lovely film, instantly forgettable, but again, a movie about Hollywood, and you know how much Hollywood loves movies about Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly. It's a total souffle, but I have no desire to go back and watch it again. I don't actually remember what happened in it. I guess at the end, learns to sing and sound comes in or whatever, but I'd rather watch Mel Brooks' silent movie, to be honest, than go back and watch the actor again. And Argo, even then, it just seemed, really? That's the best pick? I mean, it's an entertaining enough look at those events. It's far from truthful.
No, totally. Completely fabricated.
Especially if you look at the role of the Canadians and Ken Taylor, which gets downplayed a fair bit.
Seriously.
In this film. I do like the fact that there is a reference to Pizza Corner in it.
Is there? I don't remember.
When they're giving them out the fake passport, the Canadian passports, and one of them is an address on Grafton Street that just happens to be right at Pizza, like one of those apartments on Grafton by the old library.
No kidding.
If you punch the actual address on the passport into Google Maps or fake driver, or whatever the idea, whatever it is, if you punch it in, it's like right above where. JK's Donairs or whatever that place was, or
right.
I don't know. I don't keep track of what the businesses are down there. They're always shifting, but I thought, okay, well, that's sort of funny. And people at the screening, I went to one of those early screenings of it, and it was a packed house, and people got that and thought that was very funny. Uh-huh. That's hardly a reason why the film succeeds or not on the strength of its merit. And, I think maybe Ben Affleck, maybe he shouldn't have been in it.
Yeah, I mean,
haircut.
I really like him as a director for the most part, but I do not always appreciate him as a screen presence. And I felt like he was doing too much on that film. Like, seriously, dude, cast someone else. Cast your brother. I don't know, to play that role. He would have been better at it.
Well, that wraps up our session of being haters here on Lens Be Your Ears. Hopefully we found a sympathetic ear to some of our movie plights and woes. It's not that it's a really strong stand to come out and say you don't like E.T., and I'm sure we're not the only ones, but sometimes it's nice to know you're in good company. And I'll confess, I don't mind it, but I'm not a huge Empire or Raiders of the Lost Ark fan.
That's interesting.
I find it a bit mechanical.
If I'd known that before, Stephen, we might have come to fisticuffs here
that's
in the studio.
True.
Because, dude, that is a classic. That is. I hold that close to my heart.
First time I watched it, I just felt like it was a movie computer calculating entertainment value. But anyway, I'm clearly in the minority on that one. And,
I appreciate you being honest, though.
History has certainly proven me wrong on that score.
We can be honest about these things. That's what they're here for. This is like movie therapy in here, where now that we've admitted all this, we can relax and we can go about our business.
That's it for this show. Thanks for listening. Of course, you can find us on Facebook. We have a Facebook page. You can leave a comment there, and on Twitter at LensMeYourEars. And we also have a Patreon that is sitting sad and lonely somewhere online, which would love to have a visit and maybe a few dollars thrown in to boost its spirits. And you can find me online. I have a Twitter account at @NS_SCook. That's SCOOKE.
Yeah, and I have one as well. I named it after my blog, Flaw in the Iris.
And of course, as always, we'd like to thank the good folks here at CKDU FM 88.1 for letting us use their fine production facilities, and also for airing this show every other Tuesday at 5:30 p.m. And the folks at Village Soundcast Network for putting all the finishing touches on it and getting it up online so you can download it from Stitcher or iTunes or whatever podcast choice you choose. Thanks, and we'll see you.